Good morning. Delighted to welcome you for our second day of oral arguments in March. And our first case is 2012 AP 597, Scott Parkenfelder versus Steve Cody. Representing the Soo Line Railroad Company is Timothy R. Thornton. Mr. Thornton, are you a licensed lawyer in Wisconsin? Then you may proceed.
As Chief Justice pointed out, my name is Tim Thornton. I'm a lawyer from Minneapolis, Minnesota. I represent Soo Line Railroad. This court is a policy-making court. It doesn't decide individual claims. As a result, this case is not about Scott Parkenfelder or Officer Cron. This case is not about a parade. This case is not about Elm Grove, Wisconsin. What this case is about is rail transportation, the rail system that travels throughout Wisconsin and really travels throughout the country. Every day across the country, trains traverse railroad tracks. Every one of those tracks has a speed limit that's been set by the Secretary of Transportation after consideration of the conditions of the tracks and the conditions of the crossings that goes apart. This case poses the question of whether those speed limits should control or whether a letter about a parade should dictate the imposition of slow orders. And as the AAR, who's the amicus in this case, pointed out, this case isn't really about a parade. What this case is about is traffic produced by or associated with that parade. The parade didn't cause the accident. The parade didn't present the problem. It was traffic. And certainly all of you are intimately aware, painfully aware, that traffic is not unique in Wisconsin. Traffic is not unique across the United States. And there's a reason that traffic is dealt with and a means that traffic is dealt with, and that's through traffic laws. Hence, nothing substantively distinguishes the Elm Grove Parade on Memorial Day from the scores, in fact, hundreds of traffic-producing events across the state of Wisconsin and thousands across the country. This case comes down to whether local authorities can trump uniform federal train speed regulations by writing letters to railroads about traffic concerns associated with traffic-producing events. In our brief, there's 27 cases that are cited from federal and state courts since the Easterbrook decision that say that in order for a specific individual hazard to be presented, that there has to be two things. Number one, collision imminency, and number two, an aberration that the Secretary could not have taken into consideration when promulgating speed regulations.
Now, who promulgates the speed regulations?
Well, the Congress invested the Secretary of Transportation with that authority, and the Secretary of Transportation delegated that authority to the Federal Railroad Administration.
Okay.
And the Federal Railroad Administration is an agency of the federal government with a number of employees that studies tracks across the country.
What does the railroad do itself? Does it just set up the speed limit?
No. What happens is the Secretary of Transportation has set Class 1 through Class 5 tracks. And based upon the conditions of those tracks, if the railroad wants to operate at the speeds allowed by those classifications, it must maintain the tracks up to those conditions. And as Easterbrook says that the Secretary of Transportation promulgated those regulations. Later on, the Secretary of Transportation said, I didn't really promulgate those regulations. What I did is I set the standards, and then if the railroads comply with those standards, they can operate at those speeds.
That's why I asked the question, because I found it confusing in the briefs, because there was constant as to who sets the standards, and I kept thinking No, I think the railroads have something to do with it. So now that's better for me to understand.
The secretary says, if you do X, Y, and Z, then you can go A, B, C miles an hour. And so the railroads come up to the federal standards.
Okay. My question for you here is, the railroad was advised that there'd be issues of people, right? Twice, at least.
The railroad was advised that there was a potential for congestion, a potential for traffic congestion. There is nothing about a potential that is either specific or individual. And there's certainly nothing about a potential that is presents the imminency of a collision or is an aberration that the Secretary could not have taken into consideration. Quoted on page 30 of our brief is the Secretary's pronouncements from the Federal Register about traffic congestion in urban areas. And I can't quote it exactly from memory, but it's on page 30 of our brief. But the bottom line is the Secretary acknowledges the existence of traffic. He pronounces individual localized speed limits to be dangerous, and he says the safest way for traffic or train traffic to operate is at constant, steady speeds. And that's exactly what we're advocating here, because there is no reason to distinguish the Elm Grove parade from any number of events that produce traffic all across Wisconsin.
Mr. Thornton, let me interrupt you for a minute.
Sure.
What I'm concerned about is you've got a stalled van on the track. You've got the train spotting this hazard, if you will, this stalled van. Doesn't that become a specific individualized hazard? And isn't there then some responsibility on the part of the railroad?
Well, as a matter of fact, the trial court found that it was, and we appealed that to the Court of Appeals, and we lost. So there will be a trial on the train crew's reaction to seeing a stalled car on the tracks. The distinction we're making in this case is the difference between sending a letter about the potential for traffic, about the potential for congestion, about the potential for population density, and a specific individual train running into or confronting a specific individual van trapped on the tracks.
That's a good point, because that was what Justice Crooks asked, was my concern, too. If I would agree with you that notice of a parade doesn't fall outside of preemption, you still have the question of whether seeing a stalled van at the length of time they saw it, which is about a half a mile, whether that incident becomes something that falls outside of preemption. And so you agree with
that, correct? We've always conceded that. Even before the trial court, we conceded that that did present a specific individual hazard.
Okay.
Because it was a van stranded on the tracks, and a collision potentially was imminent.
I have a question that was bothering me, and I tried to find the answer to it before we came out here. Is that a question of law or a question of fact about whether this seeing the stalled vehicle on the tracks presents an imminent danger of collision?
Well, I think it becomes an established fact, because the railroad is willing to concede that that did present a specific individual hazard.
Oh, okay.
That is an exception to preemption.
Okay.
The issue then became, and the issue that we presented on summary judgment and that is going to be tried,
okay,
was the train crew's response to that specific individual hazard adequate?
Okay.
The Zimboski case versus Union Pacific Railroad, a Minnesota Court of Appeals decision, analyzed that situation exactly and found that a truck stalled on the tracks did constitute a specific individual hazard, but the train crew's response to that specific individual hazard was, as a matter of law, satisfactory and entered summary judgment in Soo Line's favor in that case.
Okay, so this is going back to the trial court for that issue.
Yeah, it's going back to the trial court regardless of what you do.
Why are we here?
With
respect, I said if it goes back to the trial court anyway for a trial on negligence, that's what it would be, right? When did they see it? Did they apply the brakes within a reasonable time so that they could have stopped, or were they negligent, right? What are we doing here? What is it you want from this court?
I'm sorry, Justice, were you going to ask a question?
Well, you can answer mine first.
All right, I'll do that. Why are we here?
Right.
We're here as, is the evidence before the trial court going to be, was the train crew's response to seeing the van stranded on the tracks proper under the circumstances, reasonable care of what a railroad should do, or does the trial court consider the notice they got 19 days ahead of time telling them that there's a potential for traffic and they should have issued a slow order? None of the 27 cases that we've cited involve anything other than the exact situation that you raised and Justice Rogensack, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
You raised, of namely a car or an individual being on the tracks confronting a train crew. There's not one case except possibly that Griffin case that talks about entering a slow order in advance of actually confronting that situation. And it'll make the scope of the trial will be extraordinarily different if everything related to the letter, everything related to that advance notice is not taken into consideration, and all that's taken into consideration is when they rounded that bend, spotted the car on the tracks, spotted the van on the tracks, sounded the horn, everybody else cleared off, mm-hmm. Did they take the appropriate steps?
Well, my next question to you then is, does preemption have anything to do with this?
I'm sorry.
Does preemption have anything to do with the case?
It has everything to do with the case.
Okay, then state the issue under preemption.
The issue under preemption is if you look at footnotes 14 and 15 in the Easterwood opinion, footnote 14 talks about that trains have very little opportunity for regulatory control and that the focus of the federal regulation is on warning drivers about the advance of a train and legislation requiring drivers to stop and stay clear of railroad tracks. I can't think of one traffic statute in Wisconsin that is specific to a situation other than the traffic statutes focused on railroad crossings. The cases are legion from this court that says an operator of a train or a driver of a semi-tractor trailer has a right to expect that another driver will obey the law until it becomes clear that they won't.
So you think that federal law preempts Wisconsin, including a Wisconsin court, right? Wisconsin court from adding an obligation to take special precautions when a particular event is occurring.
Well,
because that would then, if that's preempted, then the notice won't be able to be put forth in the trial court.
Well, there's no question that both Easterwood and Shanklin, the United States Supreme Court said the scope of FRSA, Federal Railway Safety Act preemption, extends to common law claims. And the imposition of duties upon railroads based upon common law claims are preempted. And Easterwood, footnote 15, makes very clear that preemption doesn't extend to a specific individual hazard. I don't know how a potential could be specific an individual. I don't know how it could present an imminent collision. I don't know it could be an aberration that the Secretary didn't take into consideration. But if you go on in reading footnote 15, it talks about Lizzie Easterwood's claims being preempted. And why were her claims preempted? Because she maintained that the train was operating too quickly for the time and place. And isn't that exactly what plaintiffs are advocating here? Isn't that exactly what the Court of Appeals found? And isn't that exactly what this case is about? They're saying that the train, the Soo Line train on Memorial Day, was operating too fast for the time and place of the Elm Grove Memorial Day parade. That's exactly what this case is about. And that's exactly what Justice White found to be preempted in footnote 15, or really in the entire body of the discussion in Easterwood.
Mr. Thornton, what did the letter say, the letter that was sent 90 days in advance of the parade?
I can't quote it exactly, Justice, but I'll give you the gist of it. It said, we're going to have the parade again as we've had in years past, and things get more and more crowded. People are taking up every inch of space. And there's a potential for traffic, and there's a potential for people and cars to be on the tracks or near the tracks. That's essentially what it said. That's the gist of what it said. It didn't say Ms. Partenfelder's van is going to be hung up at this crossing and a collision was going to be imminent. He said there was a potential. There was nothing specific or individual about that warning. And
if I could maybe ask the question I wanted to ask before the many questions asked by the Chief Justice.
Could I just say one thing? I'm colorblind, so could somebody tell me when I run out of time?
Sure.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Well, it's green, and then the middle one will be yellow, and then the last one will be red. You'll have 5 minutes left, if that
you
helps.
Rely on
once
me.
It's red for you, you'll still have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
All right.
Okay.
I'm sorry to have interrupted you, but I was just worried.
No, I understand. So hopefully that helped a little bit. Okay, here's my question. I'm putting on my trial court judge hat, and you might have answered my question in the several questions that have been posed to you, but when this goes back for trial, does the letter come in as evidence of what the train company knew when they approached this area, or is that letter precluded as part of the evidence under your theory?
Judge, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Wotokiak found that evidence about what happened before the train crew rounded the bend and spotted the van on the tracks is out. Because it's federally preempted.
And with a separate consideration as to the individual hazard on this day, and the evidence that goes to that does not include the train company's knowledge of or the receipt of the letter. Okay.
It doesn't. And one of the reasons that's important, the Hightower case and the Sealer case both talk about in terms of in Hightower, the railroad made a promise to the mayor that it was going to slow down the trains. And the court found that makes no difference. The exclusive speed that railroads can be held to is the speed limit set by the federal government. In the Sealer case, that was the derailment case in New Mexico that was tried in Kansas. There was an internal speed limit that was exceeded. And the court says it makes no difference. The critical consideration is the federal standard. And what Judge Wotokiak found is that once he preempted the letter, the plaintiff, and this is his words, the plaintiffs couldn't put in evidence about the letter through the back door to defeat the whole effect of his federal preemption finding. And that was the situation here. And I think the court should be mindful of an unintended consequence that may occur if you were to approve the result below. Essentially, you would empower every local authority, and I don't know if it stops at local authority. Does it go to sports teams? Does it go to high schools? To say to railroads, either stop your trains, which would shut down the entire rail transportation system across Wisconsin and across the nation, or to go slow, but doesn't that encourage and invite lawlessness? When Officer Cron testified, even though everybody at that crossing was aware that trains would be coming through at track speed, so many people were violating the law that he couldn't write enough tickets. If people knew that they could violate the law without regard to the ramifications, lawlessness would be rampant. That certainly would jeopardize public safety. And more important, or equally important, it would basically shut down the nation's rail transportation system. So that's a result that this court simply can't allow. And there just isn't any question that the secretary didn't regard increased traffic opportunity as an aberration that he couldn't take into consideration for the purposes of regulating train speed.
Counsel, does the majority in the Court of Appeals reference the letter in their discussion and analysis and conclusion?
I think I'm going by memory here, Justice. Well, I have the decision right here. I think they quoted it at length.
In the facts they did, but I'm talking about in their analysis and in their holding. They start out talking about there was a letter sent and what the letter said, but
But there's a
Is it part of their analysis in holding?
It doesn't appear to be.
It does or does not.
It doesn't appear to be. They sort of talk about footnote 15
yes.
as not creating a new exception, but recognizing an existing duty. And relying on Griffith, they sort of do an ipsy dixit and said that somehow or another, traffic or the parade, not necessarily traffic associated with the parade, constitute a specific individual hazard that obligated the railroad to issue a slow order. And then they conclude, and they bought plaintiff's argument, that somehow or another that the Elm Grove Memorial Day Parade is different than Milwaukee Brewers game, is different than Milwaukee rush hour, is different than every other traffic-producing situation in the country.
They
did reference it in their discussion, Justice Bradley, in paragraph 21 of the opinion.
That's
how they started out, by saying they knew of this parade. Well, they knew of it because they got a letter about it.
Yes, I see that in terms of the facts. They set it up, the facts. The first paragraph of the discussion has the facts, but I don't see it mentioned at all in the preemption analysis or Easterwood discussion or whether Easterwood creates a new exception. You know, none of that talks about the letter. So I'm not sure how much they relied on the letter in their analysis.
Well, I think, Justice, if you really think about what they were doing, it was results-oriented. You had an officer who should have been directing traffic to start with, who wasn't directing traffic, who went out of his way to try to help a toddler in a train or in a van that a train was approaching, and the decision was really results-oriented, as the dissent recognized.
Okay. It sounds to me as though, in part, what you're asking is akin to a motion in limine. We don't want anything about this letter. We don't want it to be brought in on trial with regard to any kind of notice that might give rise to a duty.
That's
what I hear your argument, but I don't see that jiving with the analysis of the majority. That's where I have got a little tension.
Well, it is more fundamental than that. What it is to say that the exclusive train speed duty that a railroad can be held to is the train speed duty set by the federal government. And once that's complied with, it's akin to a motion in limine. Once you find that the train speed or the duty to issue a slow order was preempted by the federal regulations, mm-hmm. you can't defeat the whole purpose of that finding by backdooring evidence that somehow they had notice of it, because having notice of it does not oblige the railroad to stop or slow down the trains. But what it does oblige, without regard to the letter, what motorists in Wisconsin are obliged to do is obey the law. And the singular cause of this accident was the failure of the Partenfelders to obey the law. If they would have stayed clear of the crossing, this incident never would have happened.
Now, Justice Presser, wouldn't you need to ask a question?
I forgot my question. I'm sorry.
Think of it.
Good morning, Judge.
Paragraphs 33 through 38.
I did remember my question. If you were in Mr. Rohde's position, the gentleman who received the letter,
yes.
Did you have any duties at all? Would you have any duties at all? Could you have said, this goes right in the trash?
Well, it's a hypothetical, of course, because he did pass on to dispatch that there's going to be a parade and be on the lookout, and the train crews were advised to ring the bell continuously, even though they were in a quiet zone, and to be on the lookout. From a hypothetical perspective, I think maybe he could have, but as a practical matter, he didn't. And he responded, and dispatch, you know, called up the parade coordinator and tried to determine what was the appropriate steps to take. But again, the controlling principle are the federal regulations. And the federal regulations were fully obeyed. In contrast, the traffic regulations were flouted.
A
Counsel, you have about 3.5 to 4 minutes because your orange light is on, but you will then have another 5 minutes in rebuttal. So I promised I would tell you. I've told you. Now I have a question or a comment. Paragraphs 33 through 38 set forth the holding of the Court of Appeals, as I read the Court of Appeals. And as I read the Court of Appeals, they are saying, the majority is saying, that the circumstances of the parade, which would include the Sioux Line's knowledge of it, that the circumstances are part of the specific individual hazard that Justice Crooks was commenting about. So they are saying the exception under the footnote
15.
Right, 15. That shows the danger of it, of footnotes. The exception in that footnote includes the background and the letter. And that's what you disagree with. Is that correct?
It's absolutely correct, and it's not me disagreeing with it. It's Justice White disagreeing with it. Because Justice White...
I have you here, not Justice White.
Well, I don't think we could have him. But unless we could do a seance or something.
Right. But stay focused, counsel. Right. Your red light's on. You may answer the question.
I'll answer the question. The distinction that footnote 15 draws... by my interpretation, what Justice White meant, is the difference between a specific individual hazard, a car or person being on the track, and a train proceeding too quickly for the time and place.
I think the Court of Appeals said speed is not the issue if the train was within the speed limit. So that's not what they're fighting about. As I read the majority, they give you that. But they say the specific individual hazard is the totality of this specific individual hazard, which is that the Sioux Line was on notice. And I hear you saying you can't change the rules of liability by giving us notice.
You can't change the rules of liability by giving us notice of a potential. If, for example, Mrs. Partenfelder's car hung up on the tracks and they went to the signal bungalow, and there's a number there, and called and said, Sioux Line Dispatch, there's a car hung up on the tracks. Mm-hmm. That train would have been obligated to slow down or stop until that car could have gone off the tracks, because that's a specific individual hazard. But a warning about a potential simply doesn't meet the test.
Thank you, counsel.
I talked over my time, and thanks for warning me.
That's fine. Mr. Devine, representing the city of Racine and Amy.
Wrong
case. I thought that's not correct. Well, whoever you are, you may proceed, counsel.
Thank you for
you are Robert Crivella.
Yes, thank you for that introduction, Chief Justice.
Well, you can handle the next one, too, if you like. You represent Cindy Cron and John Cron.
Thank you, Chief Justice Abrahamson. May it please the Court, I am Attorney Robert Crivella with the law firm of Cannon and Dunphy. Our firm represents Police Officer John Cron, who during the 2009 Memorial Day Parade in the village of Elm Grove was struck by a train at nearly 45 miles per hour while heroically trying to save a baby that was in a minivan that got stuck on Elm Grove's Juneau Boulevard crossing. Officer Cron seeks the opportunity to go into a Wisconsin court and argue to a Wisconsin jury that if defendant Sioux Line Railroad Company had afforded the same basic safety protections to parade attendees that Sioux Line affords its own employees and equipment, that this collision would have never occurred.
I wonder if you could respond to your opposing counsel's proposition about an unintended consequence if we were to follow your argument. Why is he wrong that if we see it your way, that every municipality, every locality throughout not only this state, the great state of Wisconsin, but every state in the union could inhibit or could, in fact, set the limits for the railroad?
I think that, well, there are two ways to answer your question, Justice Gableman. One is a legal answer and one's a factual answer. The legal answer, and we've cited the Shakopee case from the Court of Appeals in Minnesota, that case involved not the specific individual hazard that we're here to talk about today, but the local safety hazard under the Federal Railroad Safety Act. They're essentially the same thing, but the local safety hazard applies to municipalities, where the specific individual hazard applies under the common law to common law claims. In the Shakopee case, the city, given the business district and the traffic in that area, had promulgated a local speed limit of 10 miles per hour because they were afraid of people getting hit. And Union Pacific, the railroad company in that case, challenged the local 10-mile-per-hour speed limit. And what the Court of Appeals said in that case, in saying that given the layout of the business district and the circumstances surrounding that case, is that the 10-mile speed limit was perfectly acceptable and federal preemption didn't preempt the local government from preempting the 10-mile speed limit. Now, the railroad in that case came forward and said, the sky is falling. If you allow this local municipality to pass this 10-mile speed limit, we are going to have municipalities into court every single day trying to pass speed limits that are different than what is allowed by the federal regulations. What the Court of Appeals said is, we're not going to go down that road because it's unduly speculative. We have to decide whether or not preemption applies on a case-by-case basis. And we don't think just because the railroad comes forward with the sky is falling argument without any evidence to support that, that that necessarily is going to mean that every, you know, municipality is going to come forward with a local speed limit that's going to affect what is set in the federal regulations.
Well, what if we change it from the Shakopee facts of the passage of a law by a municipality to a letter, not just from a municipality, but, you know, there are many people whose backyards and yards abut railroad tracks and say they're going to have an event at which they anticipate having a lot of people. And they send a letter to the railroad saying, hey, on the 4th of July, we're going to have a big parade. Please slow down or blow the whistle if you would. We'd appreciate it. How is that any different from what we're presented with here?
What we don't know with what happens in other jurisdictions, and this is how I was going to try to tie in Shakopee, what's unique to this case is that you have the entire Elm Grove community, if not outlying communities, descending upon this one area to start the parade. And it's in the railroad tracks are enclosed by Legion Drive and Union Boulevard, so that you have literally...
They're enclosed by what?
I'm sorry, Legion Drive and Juno Boulevard, two roads.
Right, right.
So there's two areas of access to come to this one spot where literally thousands of people are coming, hundreds of thousands of people are coming to start the parade. There's no evidence in this record that the circumstances akin to this parade happen anywhere else in the country where you have an entire community descending upon a crossing. And what makes this case unique, and we don't have evidence that this happens anywhere else, is that the railroad company has notice of congestion, vehicles and pedestrians on top of the tracks during a train's first approach. Now, I understand counsel to say, well, we can't be held to know that people are going to violate the law and be on top of the crossing when trains first approach during parade times, but that completely ignores the evidence in this case. In all of the briefs that the defendant submitted to this court, and in the amicus brief, and this goes to Judge Ziegler putting her trial court hat on, you know, because we're at summary judgment and the facts have to be viewed in light most favorable to the plaintiff, there is an email from Steve Rohde after he gets the two notice letters. He sends an email to dispatch, and this is at record 66, page 7, and says, look out for pedestrians and vehicles on the tracks. That imputes knowledge to Soo Line that there are going to be vehicles and pedestrians on the tracks during these three specific hours when a train first approaches on the Memorial Day parade, and that doesn't happen during any other day in the village of Elm Grove. That aberration isn't taken into consideration by the Secretary of Transportation or Sioux Line in setting the speed limit at 50 miles per hour for this crossing. So to answer your question, is the sky going to fall for the railroad company? No.
For the record, that was not my question.
Okay. All right. But
the railroad companies will be just fine one way or the other, I'm sure. But my question, just so you don't misapprehend it, runs more not to the facts, not to the factual things, which of course you want to argue, but to the legal distinction of where do we as a court, of course the parties in this case are very important to us, as are all the parties, but we must not only think about the parties in this case, we must think of the fair and consistent application of the law to all future parties. So what happens if a high school has property that abuts a railroad track or a university? I can't picture any offhand, but I'm sure it's not uncommon. And they send a letter to the railroad. Same standard?
Well, it depends upon the circumstances.
Your answer must be yes if your logic flows.
Well, there are two key components to this specific individual hazard exception. The first one is going to be Sioux Line's knowledge in this case, right? What? Sioux Line knew.
You're going to argue, you're going to go back to it depends on what the facts are.
Exactly.
But as a principle of law, what rule do you want us to apply when a municipality sends a letter to a railroad and they acknowledge receipt of the letter, then they are the preemption does not apply? Is that what you want us to adopt?
I appreciate the question now, Justice. The exception to preemption in this case, despite the way that Sioux Line has framed it, isn't just based on the fact that a notice letter was sent from the municipality to the village of Elm Grove. Where the specific individual hazard exception really comes into play is the railroad's knowledge that there's going to be congestion on the track during a train's first approach.
And so if you had the opportunity to draft this opinion, your rule, your holding, you know, the only part of our opinions that most people read, would be
that a plaintiff can go into a state court and allege that a slow order should have been issued when a railroad company has knowledge of the known specific hazard of congestion on top of a railroad track during a trade's first approach, so long as it's specific to the day in question. It has to occur solely on the day in question.
But you'd have to have us also adopt your definition of a known specific hazard, too, because I think opposing counsel wants it particularized to a specific event that is a hazard, and I think imminent danger of collision is the tag that goes along with that. And what you're saying is there's a known specific hazard anytime the railroad gets notice that there's going to be congestion around this crossing, right?
Not any time, but with specificity.
Well, what certain hours of a day it's going to occur, that gives you the changeover from a general circumstance to a known specific hazard, correct?
Correct, because it only happens in this case one day a year.
I understand that. I just want to be sure I understood your argument.
So does it apply equally to my high school or college or private property hypotheticals?
I would say no, and the reason being is if you have a local high school that is heavily populated, is near the tracks, and has event after event after event after event.
What if they only have one event a year, a budget cuts, and there's only one event a year, and it's a big one, and because of the configuration of the property, it has to take place near the railroad tracks?
If there's one event a year, and you have everybody descending upon the high school, and the railroad has noticed that there's going to be people on the tracks during a train's first approach, and the railroad company acknowledges that hazard and says, yes, there will be people on the tracks during a train's first approach during that one time a year, then you have a specific individual hazard. Absolutely.
Okay. Thank you.
I remember having a trial on a parade issue, and it was a tragic event. It was a personal injury case. But I also remember as part of that, the parade route and the parade instructions to the people driving the vehicles, There were instructions given. It wasn't a free-for-all. were there instructions here? You know, you can go ahead and be on the tracks. Were there, what instructions were given to these people so that they knew what they could or couldn't do? Will that be part of the case?
The instructions from what party, Justice Ziegler, from?
When a municipality has a parade, they tell the people driving or in the parade what they can and cannot do. You can throw candy, you can't throw candy, you must stay this far from a vehicle. You can't have a float on this kind of a, I mean, there, at least that's what I've seen in, you know, unfortunate circumstances where something bad happens and that comes up. Did that happen here? Did they say, yeah, go ahead, just stay on the tracks?
The only evidence in the record with regard to any notice to the community was something that was in the paper that said, come line the streets where the parade is supposed to start during these specific times. But I am not aware of any specific instructions.
Here's my real question. When the trial court was done with its decision, were you going to have a trial on anything? And now that the Court of Appeals has rendered its decision, are you going to have a trial on anything? Do you agree, in other words, with counsel that there's still a trial here and you still are going to have your day in court or not?
If this court adopts the specific individual hazard exception that Sue Line is asking for, we won't have a trial.
I thought counsel said you would have a trial. The trial would be on whether the response was adequate.
Well, here's why we won't have a trial, and here's why if Sue Line's standard is adopted by this court, this court will have eviscerated the exception to preemption in the federal context. The trial that Sue Line is advocating for is that a specific individual hazard doesn't occur until Monica Partenfelter spins out on the tracks on the date of the collision.
Well, I thought they were stipulating that there was a specific individual hazard. The only question from their perspective, I thought, was whether their response was adequate. And then related to that response, I thought you wanted to be able to get the letter of notice in to say, hey, you should have been doing more than just responding when you saw it. You should have done all these other things to take care of this so it wouldn't happen, knowing this might come up. And I thought their response was, no, that letter doesn't come in. Just, you know, we came upon the situation. How did we respond? Did the jury think we responded okay?
What Sue Line is trying to keep out is our allegation that the train should have been coming in at 20 miles per hour or less. Sue Line acknowledges or advocates that the specific individual hazard exception doesn't begin until Monica Partenfelter spins out on the tracks. So in other words, this train comes around the bend and has about a half mile before it sees the Juneau Boulevard crossing. And the facts are that when the train comes around the bend, there are numerous vehicles on the tracks, not just Monica Partenfelter, but numerous vehicles. And Sue Line is advocating that the train can keep going, and assume that people are going to clear the tracks without any problems, and that the train doesn't have an obligation to stop until Monica Partenfelter spins out on the tracks. The problem with that being the only specific individual hazard is the plaintiff will never have a case on causation with regard to the negligence claim because by the time Monica Partenfelter spins out on the tracks, it's too late for the Sioux Line train crew to do anything to avoid the collision. And here's why.
Well, we just stop right there a minute. Why isn't when they come around the corner at the bend in the tracks and they're a half a mile away and they see all these cars on the tracks, why isn't that combined matter, the specific individualized hazard? Why is it just limited to when she gets stuck and can't get out of there?
Sue Line was advocating for it being when she gets stuck on the tracks.
I understand that, but if you're going to go back for trial, I'm not sure that saying you can't bring in the letter forecloses you from arguing they should have put the brakes on as soon as they came around the corner, which they didn't. They blew their horn and did a couple other things and put the brakes on until they were 400 feet away, right?
That's correct. But
well, that's something for trial to me.
Yes, but it's obviously not the trial we want to put on because even when they come around the tracks and see numerous vehicles on the crossing, they still can't stop in time for the vehicles.
And I think what you just said is the answer to Justice Rogan-Sack's question, that there could be a cause of action, but if the letter stays out, it's not the trial you want to have. You you must be conceding. What I hear you doing is conceding that but for the letter, the crew acted, did not act with negligence.
Not at all, Justice Gableman.
Okay.
What I'm saying is if the train crew comes around and sees numerous vehicles on the tracks, and there's a duty to stop.
Sure.
Why is the obligation any different if they know the vehicles are going to be on the tracks before they get there?
Because it's not a specific individualized hazard. It's a generalized hazard. There's a parade in the neighborhood, and there's going to be a lot of congestion there, but it's sure specific when there are cars sitting on the tracks.
If that's this court's holding, this court's holding would be that as a matter of law, that Soo Line had no knowledge.
No, it's not they had no knowledge. It's whether this fits within federal law, which is once they recognize a specific individualized hazard, then they must take action.
And the recognition happened before they got around the bend that morning.
Well,
so I agree with you.
If we would buy your, well, you don't agree with me because I see specific as an important component and you see general warning as an important component. That's, I think, where you and I differ.
I don't see general warning as an important...
Well, the letter gave a general warning. It didn't say there were going to be vehicles on the tracks.
It did. The letters did say that there would be a potential for vehicles on the tracks. And the evidence at summary judgment, Justice Rokensack, is that the railroad company knew that. There are numerous pieces of evidence. For example...
I get you. They had notice. I don't... I think you're very solid on that. I don't have a problem.
I'd like to go back to the question Justice Ziegler asked, and I'd like to ask it just a little bit of a different way because I'm not sure I heard you respond to it in the way. Could there be a cause of action, absent the letter, say somehow this court decides that preemption, there's no exception to the preemption, so the letter is out. Why couldn't there be a cause of action for general negligence?
Based upon the railroad's reaction to, because no matter what happens under the circumstances of this case, the train is going to hit whatever gets stuck on the Juneau Boulevard crossing if it doesn't come in at respect.
Under the facts of this case.
Yes.
So if the visualization had occurred not a half mile up the tracks, but 5 miles or whatever is necessary for them to stop the train, that would be a different case.
And also, even if they didn't stop the train, they wouldn't have been going 40 miles an hour when they hit the car if they put the brakes on a half a mile away.
They're still going to hit the van at a pretty significant rate of speed.
Okay, well,
under the facts of this case,
under the facts of
if you have greater distance, you'd have different set of facts. So there could, I think the answer to my question is, there could be a cause of action absent the letter. Depending on the facts of each case, a cause of action for general negligence.
That's generally true.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I guess I just don't really understand your question. But the problem here with regard to, well, even to step back to answer the original question is that the courts, or at least with regard to Justice Rokensack's question, there seems to be an agreement that when there are numerous vehicles on the track, something should be triggered in the train crew's mind to do something because we have a specific individual hazard. The case law is consistent across the board that vehicles and pedestrians on the track is a specific individual hazard. The next logical step that we're taking is, what if the railroad company has that realization before it even gets there, then the duty to slow is triggered before the train reaches the tracks. And with regard to the specific individual hazard, we're talking about two key components: knowledge, because they know that condition before they get there, and specificity. This only happens 3 hours during the day, during one day a year. And this very specific individual hazard wasn't taken into consideration in setting the speed limit at 50 miles per hour at the crossing. It's a complete aberration to this one day where you have all these people descending upon the railroad tracks, and the railroad company knows that they're going to be there. That's why Soo Line Railroad Company will slow down for their own employees when they know that they're going to be on or near the track.
All these. Well, how do they know that?
Because they have notice. They have no.
So Soo Line will change its speed when it has its own employees on the track. So you think maybe Sioux Line owes the same thing, same obligation to non-employees. Is that your argument?
In this circumstance, yes, because of the knowledge and the specificity.
Okay, here's seems to me what the issue is. Everybody agrees, Sioux Line agrees, and you agree, that if there's a specific, and apparently the footnote agrees, if there's a specific individual hazard, then we look at negligence law of the state for the claim, right?
Correct.
That's the rule of law. So what we're talking about now, it seems to me, is how, what are the factors, or what are the tests for what is a specific individual hazard, right?
Right.
Okay. Well, I think we can all agree, but maybe we can't, that when the Sioux Line engineer sees that car or person or thing on the track, sees it, totally visible, now, that's the time frame, that's a specific individual hazard, right?
Correct.
Okay. Then the question is anything else a specific individual hazard? So if they know there's an employee out there, that's a specific individual hazard.
Correct.
All right, because they have notice. So now we have to say, okay, what else will make this a specific individual hazard? And you say a factor in this case is that they got notice.
That is one factor.
They got, that's just another factor here, that they got notice and they were given a specific date, specific time, and they were told there were going to be people and probably cars, right?
Correct.
All right. So you want to add as a factor notice, and I suppose you'd want to add that it's adequate notice. I mean, you can't give it to them 3 minutes before. You can, but that's not going to help very much. Okay. So here there was enough time notice, but not, you wouldn't give it to them May 1, 2014, about May 1, 2015. That would be a little too long, right?
Correct.
All right. So you have to have it not too long, not too short before the risk. Okay. So you would put in adequate notice with a time, date, specificity, right? And what about, from what I hear of you, you would put in that they have to alert to the particular hazard. So here the particular hazard would be people and cars.
On the tracks, correct.
On the tracks. What if it were an animal? A horse with a rider.
I don't know if I would be in front of the court with the same concerns as I would for Officer Cron, but
he could be on horseback.
I suppose yes. If it's a pedestrian vehicle or thing on the tracks that triggers a specific individual hazard exception when there's knowledge of it and there's specificity, Justice.
Okay. Does it have to be unique? Because it's not unique to have a car or people on the track, right?
It has to be unique in consideration of the general conditions of the track.
I don't understand that.
Well,
tell me.
365 days of the year, other than these 3 hours, you don't have the risk of people or the fact of people being on top of the track. That's what makes this unique. It's unique to the general conditions of the track. It's something that's not taken into consideration with regard to setting the speed limit.
All right.
Could I ask, what is it that you, if I assume that the notice that was given to the railroad was perfectly adequate, what are the specific steps that you think the railroad should have taken?
What I think, what should have happened is that there was acknowledgement by the railroad company that there would be congestion on the tracks during this time frame. What the railroad company did was they put in their bulletin to dispatch to sound the engine bells. Now, this is ordinarily a continuously quiet zone where you're not supposed to do that, but all the railroad company did was sound the bells. But we're going to go through at 45, 50 miles per hour, despite the fact that there are going to be people on the tracks. What I think should have happened is that dispatch should have put a restriction in the bulletin, like they did for six other instances on the route that day, saying we have a track condition this day, you have to go in at 25 or 20 miles per hour or less because we're going to have people and vehicles on top of the tracks. That's what should have occurred in this case. And that would have completely prevented the incident because traveling at 20, 25 miles per hour, the train can stop in 350, 400 feet. And traveling at 45, 50 miles per hour, it can't stop in that half mile distance when it sees the cars on the tracks.
Why isn't your lawsuit against the officer directing traffic? In the rules of the road say 346, 45 say you got to stop and you got to stop away from the tracks and it gives you a direction. And I mean, you're not allowed to sit on a railroad track. Now, I know this is a terrible circumstance. I can't imagine as a mother with a child in the car facing a train. I mean, I think that's just terrible. But I'm looking at this. I mean, it's pretty clear you can't have your car sitting on the railroad tracks. An exception to making that kind of a stop where you're not on the railroad tracks is when a police officer directs traffic to proceed. That's one of them. But obviously that's there to say, okay, if you're going to be someone going across the tracks, either you have to stop when you stop or you need to be directed by law enforcement to do it in this particular way so it's safe, presumably. So what, if any, does that factor in at all? I mean, why aren't you suing the officer for not proceeding to direct traffic accordingly?
Well, I represent Officer Cron. And
I know that, but you know what I mean? The injuries of the Partenfelders, you never represented them?
No, they're represented by another attorney.
Did they sue the officer? I mean, it'd be the municipality, it'd be him acting in his official capacity, and there'd be, you know, other issues that come up. But, you know, I mean, the duty should, to what extent should the train company be able to assume people are going to follow the rules of the road?
Well, is there a potential that the Elm Grove Police Department is going to go on this verdict? Yes. But it's not because of the negligence of Officer Cron.
Okay, and I'm not trying to cast this. This is just a terrible circumstance all around, and everybody was trying to do their best on this. But what I'm getting at is, from the train company's perspective, should they have to anticipate that people aren't going to follow the rules of the road?
They admitted that people weren't going to follow the rules of the road in an email 10 days before the incident.
Well, they may have... To know whether or not someone might be speeding on a particular day or something might... That doesn't necessarily all of a sudden make you more negligent. So you're saying they shouldn't be able to rely on people following the rules of the road?
I'm saying in this case they did not. And, in fact, I asked the train conductor point blank, why is there a bulletin to you as the train crew to sound engine bells coming through this area when this is supposed to be a quiet zone? And he said because of congestion on the tracks. They know they're approaching this hazard. And all we're saying is because they know it before they get there, the trigger to slow down is before you get to the intersection.
Okay.
I'd like to come back. My time is up. Unless
we have
there
a couple of more minutes, and then you can wind it up, counsel.
I think this court, with regard to some of the questions that it's asking, is well, what kind of test are we going to formulate under the circumstances? And I understand that. The one point I really wanted to make before I sat is that Easterwood clearly left open the potential for plaintiffs to go into state court and allege there are some instances where the train should issue a slow order. The facts of Easterwood was that there was population density, it was a 60-mile-per-hour speed limit, and the plaintiff said under all circumstances, under the time and place, this is wrong. And Easterwood says you can't question general conditions, but you're still left open to come in and argue for a slow order under specific circumstances, and not just specific individual hazard. There are some tort law duties that are preserved. Because it would have been very easy for Easterwood to say, a plaintiff can never come into court and say a slow order should have been issued. Easterwood doesn't say that. It preserves that right under certain circumstances. If this isn't the case where a plaintiff can go into court and say the railroad company should have issued a slow order before it came around the bend, you're never going to have a case where a plaintiff can do that, and the exception is going to be eviscerated. Now, I think the Court of Appeals analysis was right when they said under 1A of their opinion, all Easterwood did was preserve the ability for a plaintiff to go into court and say, you should issue a slow order when you have known hazards like this. And they cited the Griffin case, and that was primarily the law for 23 years from 1970 when FRSA was adopted to Easterwood's decision in 1993. But secondarily, the test that the Court of Appeals adopted is the correct one under the Anderson test. It gives instances where you could have a collision that could be imminent. And even if the court disagrees with the Court of Appeals decision under 1A, discussing about stopping for known hazards, which is correct, then secondarily and alternatively, the test adopted in 1B of the decision is the correct test. And we submit we would meet the elements of the test for the exact same reasons that the Court of Appeals said we did.
Thank you, counsel. You may be seated. Mr. Thornton.
I want to start where I began my argument. This court is the policymaking court for the state of Wisconsin. The decision that this court renders will have ramifications all across the United States. We can't get bogged down in the specific facts of this case. The overwhelming, overriding consideration in this case is the potential for traffic. There is nothing unique about the potential for traffic. The potential for traffic exists in almost every community in this state. The potential for traffic-producing events occurs every place. It occurs 80 times with Brewers games in Milwaukee. What is the substantive difference between a parade that happens one time per year and traffic congestion that happens across this state all times of year? From a public safety perspective, if anything, drivers in Milwaukee rush hour are entitled to more protection than parade goers and one day in Elm Grove. But that's not what this case is advocating. Mr. Crivello is saying, well, because this parade happens one day a year, the railroad should be issued a slow order. But every place else where traffic is produced, that should be ignored.
Suppose there was construction at or near the railroad crossing that would require less speed to protect the construction workers and protect the train from debris. We notify Sioux Lines. What does Sioux Lines do?
There's a case exactly on point on that. I believe it's the Garza case. It's cited in my brief. It was a two-day construction project with dump trucks frequently going across the tracks, and the court held that there was not a duty to issue a slow order, that observance of the federal speed limits that was all that's required. It's true of weather cases. It's true of an accident case that resulted in a detour that increased traffic at the crossing. This court can't micromanage this situation, and there is nothing substantively, and I'm repeating myself, that distinguishes the traffic conditions that exist that day from the traffic conditions that happen all across this state. There is nothing specific, there is nothing unique, there is nothing individual about the potential for traffic.
And so the railroads can run at the same speed that's authorized under the regulations in these various 1 to 5 tracks and is not held to take into account specific conditions of which it has notice. It just can run right through and hit anything or anyone.
Yes, it can, because the Congress said the authority to take those conditions into consideration is vested in the Secretary of Transportation. He vested those rights in the FRA, and the FRA established speed limits. And if Justice Gableman pointed out, if individuals were empowered to say, because of this event, there's going to be a bunch of traffic, slow down. Because of this event, there's going to be a bunch of traffic, slow down. Because of this event, there's going to be a bunch of traffic, slow down. Because we have rush hour every day in Madison and Milwaukee, and you know about that slow down, just write off the nation's rail transportation system.
Counsel, it seems to me that based upon your argument before, that your answer to the Chief Justice might more accurately be yes, so long as they're willing to risk a general negligence suit.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If the traffic conditions, I mean, the one thing that was observed by Justice White in the Easterbrook decision is that the three things that influence the potential train accidents are the adequacies of the signals, the volume of car traffic, and the volume of train traffic. Necessarily, when you have more train or more automobile traffic, you have a higher percentage of an opportunity for driver error, who Justice White acknowledged was the biggest reason for crossing accidents. But the railroads are obligated, once there is a driver error, and once a driver puts himself in a position or herself in a position in harm's way, the railroads are required to respond and are required to respond appropriately. And otherwise, you're going to have a situation that you're going to have speed regulations that vary from community to community, from town to town, from high school to high school, from sporting events to sporting events, which is exactly what the Secretary on page 30 of our brief in that quote said, contributes to a lack of safety, varying train speeds. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Counsel. I want to thank
It was nice to meet you in the elevator, Chief Justice.
Good. I'm sorry that you were kept, and I hope when you went to the 16 East that you were able to register and didn't have to go to the Tenney building. And
everything worked out just the way you told us to. When the head boss tells you what to do, things work out.
That's right. Except I can't get them to change the instructions to counsel, but I'll try again. Thank you. Our discussion did not involve the speed of the elevator or anything to do with this case. Counsel, that concludes our hearing in 2012 AP 597, Scott Partenfelder versus Steve Rohde. I want to thank both counsel for their briefs and an argument, and can't remember another railroad case here. Maybe we should have more railroads crossing the country with less accidents. That concludes our hearing, and we'll take a few minutes in recess. And our second case, and there will be some students here for that. We are in recess.